I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Big changes are coming for Florida and the way it grows. This past legislative session, lawmakers voted to roll back the state's landmark 1985 Growth Management Act, which mandated developers pay for infrastructure improvements when building residential and commercial areas. Legislators also voted to eliminate the Florida Department of Community Affairs, which reviews proposed changes to local growth plans. So what does it mean for Florida? We'll talk with two experts about it. Plus, author Bill Belville discusses his latest book. It's a collection of short essays on Florida wilderness called Salvaging the Real Florida. Those conversations ahead on Intersection. Florida, for years, has counted on growth in jobs, population, and housing to fuel its economy. The good times came to a halt when the economy crashed, and now, as things are starting to look a little better, state lawmakers have made major changes to the rules that regulate growth in Florida. They eliminated the state agency that approved changes to local growth plans and rolled back rules that required developers to pay for infrastructure improvements. Here to talk about what these changes mean are Charles Lee, the Director of Advocacy for Audubon of Florida. Charles, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we're also joined on the phone by Ryan Hauck. He's the Executive Director of Free Market Florida, which supports the changes made this year to environmental and growth rules. Ryan, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
So I want to start out by throwing out to both of you, what stands out for you in the changes that were made during this legislative session, Charles?
Well, the Department of Community Affairs will go away, and the remaining group of functions that are left will be transferred to a new agency, a Department of Economic Opportunity under the governor's office. The Division of Community Planning, which will be dramatically reduced in size in terms of the number of people and the resources that it has, will handle a few remaining functions of state review over land development decisions. But by and large, the state role with regard to a check and balance on land development is going to go away.
And Charles, for you, is DCA going away, the Department of Community Affairs, bigger than the fact that the Growth Management Act of 1985 has been rolled back by state lawmakers?
Well, it's all a part of the same thing. The Growth Management Act of 1985 has been largely dissolved, and the agency that oversaw that act is essentially eliminated.
Ryan Hauck, what stands out for you among the changes made this legislative session regarding growth and conservation?
Well, we'd certainly agree that this is a fairly landmark piece of legislation. I think the most important thing that it does is limit the power of Tallahassee bureaucrats while returning decision-making capability to the local level, frankly, where officials are more accountable to the people. We think that it's a biggest step in the right direction, and it's been a long time coming. But for too long, there's been a very Tallahassee-centric approach to growth issues. And that's not right for a state as big and diverse as Florida, because what's right for Fort Myers may not work for Fort Lauderdale or vice versa. And so what this growth management legislation does is return a great deal of the decision-making capability to locals and allow individual communities the freedom to determine their own destiny.
And Ryan Hauck, though, didn't these growth management laws, these regulations, came out of a boom period for Florida? In the early 1980s, there seemed to be a call among regulators to have state oversight of those issues. So what do you see as the reason for rolling it back now if it was put in during a growth period?
Well, certainly there are some who say that this removes progress that was made in recent decades. We have the exact opposite view. We don't measure progress by the degree to which government plans, taxes, or regulates our economy. We view progress as the degree to which people are free to plan their own economic decisions for themselves, their families, and their businesses, and it's that simple. So this legislation doesn't roll back progress. It moves us forward and frankly, makes us freer. As far as the boom and bust cycle is concerned, I think it's fairly evident that every time growth management fails, its failures are used as an excuse to create more growth management regulation. And one of the biggest failures of growth management is that it artificially inflated the price of housing. and in many ways contributes to the boom and bust cycle that so many of its proponents decry.
How did it inflate the cost of housing?
Well, whether you take accounting or economics 101, one of the first lessons they teach is that regulatory and legal costs associated with business aren't paid for by businesses. They're passed on to consumers. And so extraordinary percentages in the price of housing are accounted for by increased housing costs and ultimately passed on to the end user, in this case, the homeowner. Take a look at this most recent housing downturn, where you've got states like Florida and California, which have very complex and bureaucratic growth management machines, compared to states like Texas and Georgia, where they don't have such machines. The downturn in the housing market has been much more pronounced in states like Florida and California as a result. And that's some of the biggest evidence that this type of growth management architecture only precipitates future economic downturns. Basically, they inflate the bubble. And if you don't have the bubble, you don't have the bust, and you don't have this type of pronounced economic downturn.
Charles Lee, what do you make of what Ryan Hauck is saying? Certainly, when regulators look at a system and see it's maybe not working as well, they do pile on more regulations or try to change those regulations. So was the system in Florida broken? Did it need fixing to the extent that Governor Rick Scott and the legislature have made those movements?
Well, we think they threw the baby out with the bathwater, and actually they ripped the bathtub out of the floor and threw out that out the window, too. I don't think there's any question that some adjustment to the state's growth management process was in order. But the extreme changes that took place in the legislative session this year essentially repealed all the checks and balances. And let me give you two examples of the kind of thing that is now in jeopardy. We had a situation here in Central Florida where a developer wanted to put a massive development on the shore of the Wekiva River Aquatic Preserve. And the city of DeBary had approved that. Only the Department of Community Affairs stood in the way of a 250-slip marina and a large number of houses going right on the shoreline of the river. DCA stepped in, did the right thing, said that was inappropriate. The developer recast that development, removed the objectionable features, and that development was later approved. Those kind of checks and balances will now go away, and very important pieces of Florida's environment will be in jeopardy.
Do you think our local government's going to step in to fill the void? Who is set to provide any of those checks and balances now that this state agency, which would look at what are called comprehensive growth plans and developments of regional impact, these large developments, now that that agency is no longer going to be in place, do you think the local governments will be able to step in and fill that void?
Some of them will. But unfortunately, Florida is very diverse in terms of the capabilities of its local governments. We go from local governments, I would say the Orange County land development regulation system is very mature, potentially very capable of taking this on. If you go to something like the city of DeBary, the answer, I think, would be probably not. And then the other factor that you've got is that Florida has been a hotbed of situations in which local government officials are susceptible to bribery, either the legal kind of bribery that takes place through campaign contributions or the illegal kind of bribery that takes place. I mean, we know the story of our Orange County Commissioner Fernandez here in Central Florida. We know that almost the entire Palm Beach County Commission went to prison over a period of time because of bribery incidences related to land use decisions in that county. So we do know that there are a need for checks and balances when the tremendous amount of money that's at stake in land use decisions is in front of a government agency.
Ryan Hauck, how do you see the role of local governments in picking up some of the slack here? Are you in favor of that? Are you concerned that local governments could be putting up similar stringent checks and balances as many people were concerned about at the state level?
Well, that's a very good question. I am certainly concerned about very stringent growth rules that I think ultimately have a negative effect on the economy and actually make some of these economic downturns more pronounced than they otherwise would be. That said, I also generally believe that local communities ought to have the right to largely determine their own destinies, and that's what this legislation accomplishes. Eliminating redundant bureaucracy, which was done here with this legislation in Tallahassee, is very, very important because it saves costs, but it also incentivizes expansion in Florida for businesses that otherwise might not have contemplated it. And I think when it comes to the issue, whether the issue is concurrency or other regulatory regimes about growth management, local governments are the right folks to be making those decisions because ultimately they're held accountable at the ballot box by voters, as opposed to faceless bureaucrats in Tallahassee who don't have to seek election, don't have to stand for voter review at the ballot box. We believe that voters are, in this case, the best growth watchdogs.
We're talking about the state of growth regulation and conservation in Florida after the legislative session. I'm joined by Charles Lee of Florida Audubon and Ryan Hauck of Free Market Florida, who's on the phone. This is Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. You can tell us what you think about Florida's changing regulatory climate online at the Florida Talks blog. Find it at WMFE.org/intersection. Charles Lee, I know you wanted to respond.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting if you actually look at the factual track record relating to jobs and the availability of housing. During the period from January of 2007 to December of 2010, residential development was approved under the Department of Community Affairs at a level that actually approved 1,049,000 new units throughout the state of Florida. That would have accommodated a population increase in Florida of over 2,400,000 additional people. Those units are approved. There is no regulatory constraint that prevents them from being built today. At the same time, over 2,700,000,000 square feet of commercial office industrial space was also approved through the growth management process under the Department of Community Affairs. That could have accommodated over 6 million new jobs in the state of Florida. So the idea that Florida's growth management system presented any kind of constraint on the economy or any kind of constraint on jobs is really simply an urban legend. The fact is that the reason we have a job problem, the reason we have a problem in the construction industry, has singularly to do with the lack of a market.
Well, before we get too far into the economic discussion, I do want to ask a little bit about the infrastructure conversation, which is the 1985 Florida Growth Management Act required concurrency, impact fees, developers to pay for infrastructure when they put in large developments into the state, make sure roads were improved, even schools built to accommodate growing populations. Ryan, how do you think those improvements to infrastructure will be handled now that that law has been repealed and this is in the hands of local governments?
And you're referring specifically to some of the concurrency requirements?
Yes.
Well, I think in many cases, local governments will opt to enhance, maintain, or limit those requirements as they see fit. I think this is an example, however, of regulations run amok. In many cases, concurrency, which sounds like a wonderful idea, is often misused and causes unintended consequences. And a great example of this would be when the 1985 Growth Management Act was originally enacted. It essentially said that you can't create housing developments unless there is enough capacity on roadways to handle them. And it makes a lot of sense, but in practice what it did was encourage the very type of sprawl that many environmentalists decry because developers went to more remote and decentralized locations where capacity on roadways was much lighter.
And they would have less fees to pay and to meet that extra capacity.
That's exactly right. And so the response to that, of course, by local planners was to create urban service boundaries, another artificial line in the sand that attempted to say where you can develop and when you can't. Now, these market distortions make it more difficult for individuals or businesses to plan their own economic decisions. I think Ronald Reagan actually said it very well when he said, the more the plans fail, the more the planners plan.
Well, let me ask Charles Lee, what do you think in terms of concurrency and supporting infrastructure? How's that going to get paid for now that it's not necessarily as regulated?
If you are a resident of Central Florida, hold on to your wallet, hold on to your pocketbook, because the ultimate result of failing to take care of the needs of infrastructure created by new development is over time going to be higher taxes that are paid by the general public. Now, I would agree with Ryan in terms of his analysis about transportation concurrency up to about 5 years ago. But beginning 5 years ago, it was recognized that there needed to be changes in transportation concurrency. There needed to be exception areas within the urban zone to counteract the idea of concurrency driving people to look for capacity on highways at the edge. And for the most part, the regulations on concurrency over the past 5 years have been modified to respond to that concern. But now we're in a situation where, with regard to providing services, if you are a citizen in Florida, your local governments are performing on a higher wire without a net. And the result of a fall is going to be eventually when that road is too clogged for school buses to move on, when the schools are too clogged for your kids to get into the classroom, taxes will go up on the general public to meet those needs rather than the developers having to pay for it.
Well, I do want to ask a question about conservation in terms of promoting environmental lands being saved. There was a program, Florida Forever, still is, but the funding for it is virtually dried up at the state level. And I wonder, Ryan Hauck, what is the free market answer to regulating, protecting Florida's environment?
Well, I think Florida Forever is a very worthwhile environmental preservation program, which actually uses a free market approach. And what it does is to marry economic development to environmental preservation. Essentially, they take a portion of the money that's generated by development, and it goes to a fund that the state can use to purchase land that is environmentally sensitive. This is a free market approach. It makes sense to purchase this land in the marketplace at fair value rather than attempting to confiscate the right of property owners.
But with that money drying up, though, now, is there a need to have conservation ongoing and find some other source of funding for it?
Actually, that's the very point I'm trying to make, that environmentalists ought to be the lead advocates of thoughtfully and sensibly removing some of the more onerous regulations from economic development projects, because the stronger and more robust Florida's economy is, the more likely it is to generate revenue for worthwhile environmental protection programs. Without that economic development, without that job creation, there's not sufficient funding to fund those programs. And so that marriage not only makes sense, but I think it ought to continue in that way. If we're not getting job creating activity, there's no sense in taking money from taxpayers to fund projects of that nature. I think it's necessarily and thoughtfully wedded to economic development.
Charles Lee, what do you think of that approach?
Well, Ryan and I would agree on the appropriate relationship of Preservation 2000 and Florida Forever to the fact that it's paid for by documentary stamp taxes that are generated by development. But where I think we would disagree is on the concept that our growth management regulations had any material effect on restraining the economy, restraining jobs, or restraining the aggregate amount of development in Florida. As I indicated earlier, between 2007 and 2010, enough commercial square footage in Florida was created to have 6 million more jobs. There was no constraint on the economy that was caused by the growth management program. All those units, all those square feet are available to be built on today. Nobody's building on them, not because of regulations, but because you can't get mortgage money to build.
That's Charles Lee, the Director of Advocacy for Audubon of Florida. Ryan Hauck is the Executive Director of Free Market Florida. Gentlemen, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Coming up on Intersection, author Bill Belville and his latest book, Salvaging the Real Florida. Bill Belville is a Sanford-based nature writer and documentary producer. He's the author of 6 books, and his latest is called Salvaging the Real Florida, Lost and Found in the State of Dreams. Bill Belville, welcome to Intersection.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
Great to have you in. So your book is a collection of nature essays that's been based on your many years of experience exploring the real Florida. You go hiking, you go kayaking, scuba diving, all kinds of activities. So what's the real Florida to you?
The real Florida is any place that happens to have a natural landscape somewhere nearby. And when we talk about real Florida, we often mean natural Florida. That is Florida without the golden arches and the asphalt. But it can be places, too, that are shaped by the natural landscape. That is the culture that helps us understand a sense of place. So in one story, I go to Key West. I spend a couple of days there walking around the streets trying to figure it out. And then I really do come to some sort of understanding about it, but by going into the backcountry with a backcountry guide and getting some sort of context on the place itself. So I think we find that in most places in Florida. It's not just a natural place. It's how folks respond to that natural place.
And I wonder about that. I mean, the location of it, where does it necessarily have to be? Does it have to be away from urbanism, or isn't that part of Florida because it does exist?
And that's a good question. It doesn't really have to be away from urbanism. There's a story or two in here in which I just talk about my backyard. And I've made a point to sort of bring a relic of nature into my backyard. I fenced it in. It's a wildlife habitat. Things grow there far beyond the St. Augustine grass that used to be there. You get birds, you get animals that come through. You get a feeling of nature. So you don't have to be out in the midst of a swamp somewhere. You don't have to be 70, 80, 100 feet under the water or inside of a spring. You can sometimes just walk down the street of a place like Sanford, an old brick street, great old live oaks that are canopied overhead, and you have a feeling that there's realness about the place. You know, there's a sense that folks are living here because they enjoy this place.
Is it somewhere that you have to go by yourself, or can you be in the company of others to experience the real Florida to find it?
I think it can work either way, and of course it does depend on the company of others. Some folks get it right away, and you can usually tell by chatting with them a bit how they view natural Florida. You know, is natural Florida an attraction at Disney World for them? If it is, they probably wouldn't really enjoy the places that I might want to go. You know, if folks say, hey, I really like to get there, but I've never been by myself, I think, well, hey, this is great. Let's give it a go. And they can enjoy the discovery. And every time I go, even if I go back to the same place, I always see something new. So I don't mind going back to the same place. But I also make a point to try to find as many places as I can throughout Florida where I can go and I can enjoy what Florida's about.
What's a place that keeps bringing you back?
That's probably the place I can get to the quickest. I guess I live in Sanford. I live outside of Sanford. And we're fortunate, you know, overall in Florida to have an awful lot of land protected publicly. There's about a third of our land, if you include waterscape as well as landscape, that's protected as federal, state, or county parkland. So that stacks up very favorably to most states where it's only about 16 or 17%. So we have the opportunity to go to places where places otherwise might not exist. They might be paved over, might have turned into something else. Not far from where I live is the Wakaiva River system. There's 110 square miles around the Wakaiva that's publicly protected. So there's an awful lot of opportunity out there, and it's not terribly far from where I live. So I can go there almost any time. If I have 15 minutes to drive out there, I can do that, and then I can walk around most of the afternoon if I want to into the evening.
Well, give us a sense of the real Florida from the book that you've got and you've got with you here. Give us a sense of what that real Florida is maybe all about.
Well, here's an essay, and I call these literary essays. I hope that's not too presumptuous, but they're essays in the sense that they are stories or vignettes. And an essay can pretty much be anything about almost any subject. But these are vignettes. These are little stories that start and stop. And they're what Tom Wolfe, the writer, has called new journalism. That is, it's nonfiction, but using fiction writing techniques. So you set the stage, you do all the sorts of things that one does in creating fiction, except you're telling a real story. So here's an essay entitled River Keeping with Tree. The upper river of the St. John's is altogether a separate place. Wide marshes and big skies, airboats and gators, and so many braided, shallow channels that I usually spend as much time getting lost here as not. Most maps of a century ago don't even show much of the river at all below Lakes Harney and Jessup, even though it extends southward beyond there for another 100 miles or so. My friend Michelle is on a quest to paddle and chronicle all the hundreds of miles of this complex river system for a documentary film she's shooting. Sometimes I come along, shirping kayaks from a car top to water. And today, I'm paddling with her. The channel isn't dredged or marked down here, so paying attention to navigation is essential. We're low-tech and sort of snobbish about it, preferring a compass and map over a GPS. Besides, even when electronically charted, the channel can transform, reinventing itself overnight. So we brought along a good topo map, camping gear, some food, and drinking water. You realize how little you actually need to sustain yourself when you have to physically paddle all of it in and out of any place. Earlier in her trip, my friend navigated Puzzle Lake in the kayak by herself, but in doing so, she ran across a Vietnam vet who was getting ready to set up camp out in the marsh that is Puzzle Lake. The vet, who likes to go by his old CB handle of tree trimmer, had just finished an extended 20-year camping excursion on the nearby Econlockhatchee River. When she first spotted Tree from her kayak, he had broken down his entire camp and was floating it on a jumble of wooden pallets and buckets and canoes out towards Puzzle Lake, pushing it along with a small aluminum skiff powered by a gasoline kicker. Atop the moving flotsam flew a black POWMIA flag. To her, Tree looked like a guy who'd been camping out for 20 years, deeply tanned with a wild, sun-bleached beard and hair frizzed out as if he'd just been struck by lightning. Sure, he was raw, he wouldn't practice or socialize, but there was something intriguing about him that begged for his closer look. Having a guy living off the land in modern Florida also had great appeal for me for obvious reasons. Still, there was that great unknown factor. After all, this wasn't a movie character from Central Casting, but a flesh and blood menage of a half-wild man who took more comfort surviving in the marsh and swamp than in a condo. And there were all those Vietnam memories that had been simmering in a hot Florida wilderness for the last two decades.
So you really get an evocative sense of just what you can encounter just on a little excursion in Florida, and that there are people who are so deeply immersed in it that they become it and it becomes them.
Well, that's true. And again, it has to do with the amount of land that we do have that's publicly protected. And in many cases, you can do your own excursions, whether it's by foot, by kayak, or by scuba gear, to this land under the water. You can put yourself back in the time, 200, 500, 1,000 years. You can see what Florida used to look like.
Bill Belville is a local writer and filmmaker. His latest book is a collection of essays called Salvaging the Real Florida. Thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome, Mark. Pleasure.
Hear Bill Belville describe his writing process and adventures from creating his latest book online at WMFE.org/intersection. There you'll also find links to our weekly podcast and the Florida Talks blog. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.